The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme...
When you're not directly involved in yourself, it's very hard to exactly relate to it. But at the same time, you do understand a common humanity, that there was a loss of life, that there was a tragedy.
The story of a British troop ship sunk by a U-boat during World War II and how its loss is remembered in County Donegal. Also...
Even though they didn't know what caused it, they had all kinds of thinking about what it might be that caused it. And one of them was it was a corruption of the air. So if you spoke to somebody or you were in close contact with somebody who had the plague, it wasn't looking good for you.
The Black Death in Ireland, the devastating impact of the deadliest plague in human history. Plus...
Joe O'Connor, who was the commandant of 3rd Battalion, he wrote later on that, you know, this was an example of what not to do as an urban guerrilla. And what not to do was to get involved in a stand-up fight.
We'll explore the events of 100 years ago today, the 14th of March 1921, a day of political violence in Dublin City. We begin this evening with the SS Muhammad Ali El Kabir. That's the name of a British ship which was caught in the chaotic Battle of the Atlantic during World War II and one of the many vessels torpedoed by a U-boat. It sank hundreds of kilometres off the Donegal coast, and in the following weeks, dozens of bodies washed ashore at Glencolum Kill in the southwest of the county. I'm joined by our reporter Mark McMenamin, who's been finding out more about this story. Mark, you're very welcome indeed to The History Show.
Thanks very much, Miles.
And the ship had a life, apparently, before it became a troop ship.
Yes, it had a life, and a very interesting life it had indeed, Miles. It was originally christened the SS Tenno, built in Scotland in 1922, and plied its trade mainly for the Aherlyn Company. It was a kind of one of these twin steam passenger liners, and it took a route from Valparaiso to Panama and onward to New York City, roughly from about 1922 to 1935. Now, it changes its name when it is sold to an Egyptian company. The sale was kind of due to the economic downturn following the Wall Street crash in 1929, and in the years afterwards, it's bought by the Egyptians. And of course, we know that, you know, it's part of the British Empire, which is important to its later story then. It's named after an Egyptian king, the SS Muhammad Ali El Kabir, and it then is kind of moving along kind of from Cyprus to Malta and onwards to Marseille. King Farouk of Egypt even has his honeymoon on board it, so it's a well known ship indeed.
So you've been speaking to a couple of local historians about the sinking of this ship. Let's first of all hear from Donegal schoolteacher and historian Seosamh O'Kelly on how the ship became part of the British Navy.
As we know, Egypt at that time was part of the British Empire and very much controlled by the British system and the British government. And so when World War II broke out, the British required ships, and this ship was one of these ships that they seconded, as you could say. They took it into the British naval fleet, and it was used then as a troop carrier, and they increased her tonnage and her capacity. And so that from 1940 on then, it was in the service of the British Navy during the war.
That's Seosamh O'Kelly talking about how the ship became part of the British Navy. Now, like so many seaworthy vessels, the SS Muhammad Ali El Kabir was requisitioned for the war effort. The Battle of the Atlantic then goes on to be essentially the longest running military campaign of the war. It goes all the way from 1939 to 1945. And Mark, you also spoke to local historian Brian Drummond. So let's hear more now from Brian on the Battle of the Atlantic.
Well, the Battle of the Atlantic is a big battle. It's described by a lot of historians as the longest battle of the war. Ships were being sunk all the time, all through that time period. And the UK basically needed 1 million tonnes of materials per week imported. And that's everything from munitions to oil to war materials to food as well. And it's a big, big battle. And the numbers in it are horrific. It is an Allied victory, but it's a great cost to the Allies. There's 3,500 ships lost, merchant ships lost. There's 175 warships lost, over 700 aircraft. Between sailors and merchant seamen and the rest, there's guts of 60,000 men lost in this battle. And it's every bit as fraught for the Germans as well. They lose almost 900 U-boats, 780-odd U-boats are lost. Their surface fleet, the famous Tirpitz, the battleship Bismarck, their entire services fleet is almost taken out of it as well. And they lose like 30,000 sailors. And the attrition rate for the U-boat service was something like 75%. And that's 75% dead because these guys didn't come back from the sea. Churchill himself, when he described the Battle of the Atlantic, he said, "The only thing that frightened me during the war was the U-boat peril. I was more anxious about this battle than any other battle in the war, including the Battle of Britain." That's the type of war it was, and that's the type of battle it was.
Brian Drummond there talking about the Battle of the Atlantic. And the SS Muhammad Ali El-Kabir was caught up in this maelstrom of naval warfare. Mark, talk to us about the strategic importance then of Ireland during the war, of the seas and the coastlines around the country.
Yeah, well, Ireland was very important because it lay in what was known as the Western Approaches. Now, what were the Western Approaches? So if you were to take John O'Groats at the top of the United Kingdom and you were to take Land's End and you were to draw two parallel lines 700 miles out west, including Ireland, that was the Western Approaches, okay? And that was where the ships, that was kind of the box or the window where ships coming to England had to pass through, okay? The closer that you came to the coastline of Ireland, the safer, in effect, you were. So ships travelled in convoy all along what are called the Western Approaches, and in particular, the northwest coast of Ireland, in around the Donegal area, was of huge strategic importance. They would kind of try to stay as close to the coastline as possible, and when they rounded the top of Ireland, then they were kind of free and into safer waters and could make onward journeys then on to Liverpool. So from a strategic point of view, the Western Approaches and the coast of Ireland, in particular the coast of Donegal, an area I suppose we're looking at, you know, maybe 200 to 300 nautical miles off the coast of Donegal, was strategically important in the Battle of the Atlantic. And of course, from the very outset of the war, you had the Kriegsmarine with their U-boats out to stop any ships coming through that area.
Okay, so let's hear again from historian Brian Drummond, who describes how the boat sank.
It's about 230 nautical miles away from the Donegal coast. It's a fair bit out. If you think about it, Dublin is closer to this point than the Donegal coast than the ships are. The convoy is zigzagging, but late in the evening, after 9 o'clock in the evening, about 9:30, the convoy is attacked. The convoy is zigzagging, but it doesn't help the ship. A U-boat, U-38, we know the name of the U-boat, fires two torpedoes and one of them hits the ship. Now, what happens to the ship is it starts to sink, but it's sinking slowly. It has 2 hours to sink. It actually sunk after 11:30 in the evening. But it allows time to get the survivors off. 11 lifeboats are put in the water, 20 life rafts, but the seas are rough. And there's documented evidence that men being washed off the life rafts. There is an escort vessel, HMS Griffin, and HMS Griffin basically chases off the U-boat using depth charges. It returns to go and pick up the survivors, and it collects 766 survivors, but 97 men are drowned in the sea. And of that group, most of those bodies are lost. But over the next 2 weeks or so, along the Donegal coast in particular, 33 bodies are washed ashore.
Mark, what kind of place was Donegal in those days? It must have been absolutely shocking when those bodies started to wash ashore.
It's a shocking incident in any time, okay, for bodies to start washing up on shore. But for the people of Donegal, particularly West Donegal, today it is still quite an underdeveloped area. There's a good tourist trade and everything else, but very underdeveloped and very rural and remote. And in those days, that was even more so. It was largely Irish speaking. There was high immigration. So for bodies to start washing up on shore was particularly, it was like something totally massively out of the ordinary, out of the blue, a crazy thing for these people to see. Very frightening indeed. The locals, I suppose, they saw the humanitarian side of it and they quickly started taking some of the bodies in, and obviously they were not able to identify them, but they made arrangements for them to be buried locally then.
Now, we know the name of the U-boat captain who actually fired the missile. What else do we know about him?
Yeah, this guy, Henry Lieber, was a very, very interesting guy indeed. He actually, in his career, he sank 34 ships. Okay, as a U-boat captain, he sank 34 ships in his entire career throughout the duration of the war. The interesting thing about Henry Lieber is that he only died in 1997, which makes this story like it's a very, very recent history, you know, if anything else.
Let's hear from, again, historian Brian Drummond speaking about the bodies that washed ashore in Donegal.
To be fair, there's not much detail on that. It's fair to say that they did do their best. Bodies were collected. In this instance here, as in all instances, the Gardaí were involved. The thing about it is when body's been in the water, and certainly when it's been in the water for a number of days or weeks, it may not be in the greatest shape. And identification is something that needs to be taken into context as well. Essentially, when bodies were taken ashore, it was reported to the guards, there's a proximity to the border, so bodies can be repatriated. But there is this thing as well, that as the bodies come in, how do you identify them and how do you know who it was?
Brian Drummond talking there about the bodies washing ashore in Donegal. And here's Joseph O'Kelly on how the sinking was commemorated in the area in recent years.
When you're not directly involved in it yourself, and you don't know the people that are the families and the people that were deceased or the survivors, it's very hard to exactly relate to it. But at the same time, you do understand a common humanity, that there was a loss of life, that there was a tragedy, and that these people, be it on whatever side of the divide they were when we came to the war, they were human beings first and foremost. And, you know, it wasn't for us to decide one way or the other with regards to that. If we could have been of help and assistance, we would have been. And the people of Donegal back in the 1940s during the war were. And so it's taken some time, but there was a commemoration back in 2014. The local priest father, or the parish priest father, Francis McAteer, they erected a lovely Celtic cross with the circle around it. They erected one of those to commemorate it, and a small flag as well. So look, it's obviously in the community memory. Again, they don't necessarily have an understanding of everything that was involved in it, but they do understand that there was a loss of life off the coast, and that at best it shouldn't be forgotten, and that it should be commemorated. And for that reason, it's still very much alive in the memory of the people. And there are probably people that still have the stories of what happened. Obviously, they've seen the bodies being washed in, and many of them were buried in local graveyards. About 30 of the bodies were actually later washed in over the following 2 weeks.
So, Mark, that's just one way in which the incident is commemorated locally in Donegal. You spoke to both Brian and Joseph about commemoration and its challenges when it comes to World War II.
Yeah, there are a lot of challenges, I suppose. The interesting thing is, you know, this is commemorated locally in quite a nice way with the Celtic cross that Joseph mentioned. And, you know, there's been kind of local ceremony, and there have been relatives that have been in touch with some of the locals in Donegal. And that's been a nice element to it. Where I'm from in Donegal as well, I'm from South Donegal originally, in parts of West Fermanagh as well. You see numerous commemorations of downed aircraft that crashed in the area. And that's all well and good. But I think when we look at this in the round, and we look at, you know, the fact that Ireland certainly wasn't neutral, you know, neutral with a small n, that there should be a kind of a wider recognition of Ireland's role in the war. And we should kind of, I suppose, readjust and look at and reappraise the way that Ireland was actually involved in the war, you know, from a point of view of the Donegal Corridor, which allowed ships to pass out over Donegal out into the Atlantic. You know, we actually had an incident that not many people know of British ships docking in Killybegs in Donegal, you know, and that has been under the radar as well. And of course, then there's the huge intelligence cooperation that was going on between the Irish Secret Service and the British and the American OSS. When we take all that in the round and we look at things, perhaps it's appropriate in the years coming up now ahead that we reassess and we have a new look at the way we are going to commemorate World War II in this country.
Well, Mark, thank you very much for bringing that story, the tragic story of the SS Muhammad Ali El Kabir, to our attention. Many thanks for joining us this evening.
Thanks very much, Miles.
After the break, we'll be winding back the clock all the way to 1348 and hearing about what happened when the dreaded Black Death arrived in Ireland.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
We're going back now to 1348, the year that Ireland fell victim to the dreaded Black Death. The bubonic plague killed tens of millions in Europe alone, wiping out a third of the population and leaving countries reeling socially and economically. The Winter Dress is the name of a new historical novel telling the story of fear and upheaval experienced in the face of this unknown disease. The author is Angela Keogh, who joins me now to talk about some of the history that underpins her novel. Angela, you're very welcome to the History Show.
Thanks very much, Miles. Thanks for having me on.
Now, you actually wrote this book before the COVID-19 pandemic, blissfully unaware of any modern resonance that the novel's setting would actually have. It's set partly in Castledermot, which at the time apparently was known as Trisseldermot. Tell me something about Castledermot in the mid-14th century.
I will indeed. Have you ever been to Castledermot?
I have. It's a lovely town.
It's gorgeous, and it's just got an amazing amount of landmarks of all the layers of history in it. If you're in St. James's, that's the old settlement, the first settlement that St. Dermot initially established, and it was called Tishal Dermida, I think, then, and then it changed to Thistle Dermot, and then it went back to Castledermot. So in the graveyard alone, there is a hogback Viking stone from the 10th century. There's a swearing stone, which with a hole in the middle of it, you can put your hand through it and shake hands with somebody else and make a bargain on consecrated ground. That's early Christian. There's a round tower. There's two high crosses with the stories clearly engraved on them, Daniel and the Lion's Den and that kind of thing. It was a teaching tool. That's before you even leave St. James's. There's a Romanesque church doorway of the old church. And that in itself, I found just so inspiring. Across the road from that, there's the Franciscan Abbey. And that has a carved tomb in it. Now, although it came from the 1500s, probably, it depicts two people who died of the Black Death, of the plague, and the kind of skeleton figures of Joanna Skelton and James Tallon on the tomb. And then behind that, there's the Holy Well. Up the street, there's the old wall of the town, which would have been in place at the time. You can just see a fragment of it. And then there's the Carlow Gate out the side of the town. And then you pass the pub, which used to be the Parliament House. There was a travelling parliament that used to sit there. And there was a pub called the Garter Inn there, which was owned by the nuns of Graney, which was just out the road. And then at the top of the town, there's St. John's Leper Hospital, which is still standing in somebody's garden. It's just so fascinating. And all those layers, I suppose, and landmarks combined to really inspire me to look closer at that period.
So a town utterly impoverished when it comes to history and archaeology, Castledermot, yeah. One of the things that fascinated me was that it was, to some extent at least, a French town in the period that we're talking about. What was that all about?
That's right. So the early Irish church was there first, and they had been burned a lot by Vikings, of course. And at some point, a Norman settlement of monks arrived to the Franciscan order. They were French-speaking, and for a couple of hundred years, the town was a walled French-speaking town. I thought that was just extraordinary. I even now, and every time I think of it, it stops me in my tracks. It was a walled French-speaking town.
Now, were people aware that the Black Death was on the way? I mean, obviously, communications were nothing like then what they were even a century, two centuries later. So did they know it was coming at that stage?
Yes, they did, and hoped it wasn't coming. But yes, they did know it was coming. I was amazed. I did a short medieval history course in Carlow College. And when Dr. Margaret Nolan put the charts on the walls of the trade routes, global trade routes, it was like looking at a map of Amazon today. It was just much slower. So the trade routes were really well established. You could get anything, anything. You could have silks, you could have olives, you could have all kinds of spices. So things came up from China as far as maybe the south of France. And then they came on up through France in Europe from there, right up north to England, to Ireland. So much of it travelled on the trade routes. So yes, people knew it was coming. There's accounts from a friar in Pisa, and sailors came in on a boat, and it was said that anybody who spoke to them died. Even though they didn't know what caused it, they had all kinds of thinking about what it might be that caused it. And one of them was, it was a corruption of the air. So if you spoke to somebody or you were in close contact with somebody who had the plague, it wasn't looking good for you.
Let's get this in some kind of perspective. What was the impact of the Black Death all over Europe, never mind in Ireland?
That's what I found really interesting, was that this was a European, a global problem that devastated Europe. So some accounts say 43 million people died from the Black Death in Europe, and other accounts say 30 million. But no matter what way you look at it, it's really high. Hundreds of thousands of towns and villages were left completely empty afterwards. We have our own chronicler in Kilkenny who wrote about the Black Death and wrote that once it came into a house, everyone else seemed to go the same way as death, I think was the way he put it, which I thought was pretty clear.
Now, you mentioned the chronicler. You're talking there about a man called John Clynn. Tell us a little bit about him, and do we have any idea what actually happened to him?
John Clynn was writing the daily accounts of life in Kilkenny. He had come from maybe Clonmel or somewhere like that, and then moved to Kilkenny and began to do his job, which was he was a scribe. So he wrote in maybe who married who, important events that happened in the city, mainly down to the people who supported his particular religious order. So the people who were wealthy and the people who were important. So their events, their life events were recorded. But then if something really huge was happening, that did make its way into his work. And he wrote about the Black Death arriving in Kilkenny on Christmas Day, 1348. He wrote about the contagious nature of the disease, and he wrote something really interesting. So the Black Death was called the Black Death because people had these boils and they were black, and there's much account of it. But it changed from the bubonic plague to the pneumonic plague. Now, before COVID, I had no idea what that meant. But now I have some understanding because I'm an expert virologist now. what that means. So what that meant was it was a slower transmission in the beginning. And when it became the pneumonic plague, it had mutated, I suppose, and it was then spread through the air. It was spread through droplets, and that's why it spread so quickly. And he described what it looked like when people had the plague, and he described both types of plague. So his work was useful to scientists 700 years later.
And certainly there was no shortage of social distancing in operation during this period, I believe.
That's right. Fear made hostages of everybody. So towns were shut. People tried to stop people coming into a town or going out of a town. Some people boarded themselves into their homes. This is all over Europe now, not just in Ireland. But funnily enough, some responses to the plague were for people to drink a lot and make merry, because on one hand, people thought they were going, death was imminent. And on the other hand, they did have some kind of a belief that if they were really happy and had happy thoughts and happy experiences, that death wouldn't visit them. Other people boarded themselves into their houses, and other people fled, especially the wealthy. They fled the towns and cities because they heard what had happened in other places. And people said the best way to survive it is to flee it. So that was written.
And did people, were there folk beliefs? Were there local beliefs about potential cures? Were there beliefs about who was actually carrying this terrible disease?
Well, you know, Miles, it was because of the women. That's the first thing I have to tell you. The women brought it. And the second thing was that it was down to the Jewish people. So I found this really fascinating because, you know, sometimes we look at modern history and we wonder how things happened. We wonder, how did the Holocaust happen? How could that actually happen? And when you look back through history, the Jews were persecuted at the time of the Black Death. Rumours set out that they had poisoned the wells. All over Europe, there were unbelievable massacres that happened to the Jews. All over Germany, Spain, Italy. They weren't put to death in England, but the rumours were there, you know, that this, they had brought it. Awful atrocities. But then there were other things, you know, it was a punishment from God for the way people were living. And the church really took hold of that particular concept because, you know, it made people turn back to God and made people be a little more devout. And funny enough, there was some competition at the beginning between the physicians and the church. The church wouldn't have liked that the physicians would have had the kind of power to cure people, when traditionally, of course, that was the job of saints and the church. So if somebody was cured after being visited by a priest, that would mean that the saint who he had called upon would be praised. But if the person died, it was the priest who was blamed. So the saint was never blamed. So yes, and then the physicians had all kinds of cures. One of them was if you killed a pigeon and rubbed it on your head, that could have a beneficial effect. They lanced the boils and burnt them. And that did seem, that of all the things I read about, that did seem to have some value. And I'm sure it was pretty painful. People thought because of the corruption of the air, if they fumigated places, so there was huge amount of fumigation went on. Apple wood, lavender, all kinds of things were burnt and smoked. So much so that it killed some animals, I think, at the time. There was so much smoke, kind of. Bells were rung to change the air. Animals were driven through the town to change the air. And just people didn't really know what to do. And I suppose somebody had an idea and they went with it and tried it. And then the next town heard about it and they tried it too. And that's how it worked.
But it wasn't, apparently in Ireland anyway, an equal opportunities killer. It had different effect on the Anglo-Normans and the so-called Wild Irish, didn't it?
Yes, absolutely. So if you go back to the example of Castledermot, and you had the life within the town walls. Just outside the town walls, there were several raths. You can still see some of them today. Up at the top of Mullacreeland, there's the old rath of the O'Toole's, where St. Lawrence O'Toole came from. So their life would still have been somewhat nomadic, although that was difficult to do at that period because lands, they had been moved off lands. But they ate more meat than the people in the town, especially the poorer people. They didn't live in as close contact with, I suppose, people who were trading and, you know, strangers coming from lots of different areas. They were of themselves, although they did trade with the towns. So it affected them much less. And interestingly enough, I thought, that meant that when the Black Death came to an end, or that wave came to an end, the Irish chieftains and the Wild Irish kind of shifted the balance of power again, because the populations of the towns had decreased so much that they regained an awful lot of ground and an awful lot of power after that.
How did it end, do we know? Was it just the case that it ran itself out, that there was nobody left to infect, that kind of thing?
Yeah, that wave would have ended like that. And another wave would have come along a few years later. And there were many waves all the way up to the 1700s. There was a wave of plague. And I think it's not really until the 19th century where physicians discovered ways to inoculate and cure diseases that it was brought to an end. And funny enough, I read one account that said that most of the people who survived generations after were people who actually had some immunity to the Black Death. That only the people who survived, and when the waves came, they had some immunity to it.
Now, you mentioned the church. How important, how central was the church in Ireland during the Black Death? What kind of a role did the church play during this period?
So I think you can't look at Ireland at that time in any shape or form without looking at the church, because church certainly was culture. Now, there were kind of two churches. There was the Irish Church and the Roman Church, and they were both operating on slightly different lines. So some things, like, you could still marry several times in the Irish Church. You could leave your husband or wife, and all the children of that marriage, even if you married again and had more children, all the children were equal, of equal status. And the church didn't like that at all. So they had changed that rule that only the first marriage was the one that was legal, and only those children were legally of that marriage. And it was hundreds of years before that practice died out. I always thought these things happened kind of, you know, a rule was made and then everybody followed it. That was not the case at all. Those practices continued alongside the practices of the new church. When the Black Death started in Ireland, it affected everybody, and it affected in particular the people who were tending to the dying. And that news travelled from Europe, but also from Dublin, or that where it came in first. And so people were afraid to tend to the dying. John Clynn writes about it. I have a quote here, actually. The pestilence was so contagious that whosoever touched the sick or the dead was immediately infected and died, so that the penitent and confessor were carried together to the grave. So it was a big ask, you know. I'm not saying people shouldn't have done it, but people did find themselves without somebody to tend to them on their deathbed, yes. And it all happened so quickly as well. So in the Franciscan Friary alone, in 1 week, 8 of the clergy died. So there wasn't the staff. That was another problem.
The plot of your book involves two central characters. Rose, a wild Irish dressmaker. She wasn't wild herself, but she was one of the wild Irish, as it were. And Brother John, who's a Norman monk. The novel itself is called The Winter Dress. It's published by The Harvest Press and available exclusively at theharvestpress.ie. The author is Angela Keogh. Angela, many thanks for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Thank you very much, Miles.
I just wanted to say a quick word about a new oral history project which is focusing on Garda Síochána. Next year will mark the 100th anniversary of a meeting at the Gresham Hotel by members of a committee formed by the Provisional Government of the Irish Free State. At that meeting, attended by the likes of Michael Collins and Richard Mulcahy, plans were made to organise a new police force, which led to the foundation of An Garda Síochána. Now the Retired Members Association is working on a project called Capturing Our History, an oral history of An Garda Síochána 1922 to 2022. The aim is to record and capture the living history of policing in Ireland and add to the lore of recorded history of the service. They're looking for retired members, serving members, their families and the wider public to participate and to share photographs, records and, of course, memories and recollections. To take part, you can get in touch at gardaretired.com/contact. That's gardaretired.com/contact. After the break, the Battle of Brunswick Street. We'll hear about one of the most violent days in the War of Independence, which occurred 100 years ago today. Stay with us.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back. 100 years ago today, on the 14th of March 1921, it was a day of violence in Dublin City. In fact, it was the worst day of political violence in the capital since Bloody Sunday, 21st of November 1920, 4 months earlier. To talk about this, I'm joined by historian John Dorney, editor of theirishstory.com and a presenter of the Irish History Show podcast. John, you're very welcome indeed to the programme.
Happy to be here.
So on the 14th of March 1921, at 25 past 8 that morning, news of the executions of six IRA volunteers was read to a large crowd gathered outside Mountjoy Jail. Why exactly were these six men hanged?
Well, there were five of the six were members of the Active Service Unit, the full-time, very small full-time corps of the Dublin Brigade of the IRA, and they had been caught in an ambush in Drumcondra in January. It was one of the first actions of the ASU. They were being hanged under martial law. It was a military trial. Unlike in Cork, say, that wasn't a summary military trial. Like, for example, in February, six IRA men were executed in Cork, you know, after being court-martialed the same day. Now, in Dublin, wasn't under that kind of martial law. It was under the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act. So it was a bit more prolonged. It was out in the open. There was a lot of time for drama to build up. One other of the men, Patrick Moran, was being charged with his involvement in Bloody Sunday. He was actually involved in the killings on Bloody Sunday. He was involved in killing two British officers, or one possibly not British officer, but in the Gresham Hotel on O'Connell Street. But he was charged actually with another killing, which he wasn't involved in. Patrick Moran had the chance to escape with Ernie O'Malley and Simon Donnelly from Kilmainham Jail, but turned down the chance on the basis that he thought he would get off in the trial because he was, you know, being charged with the wrong murder, effectively. But no, he didn't get off, and they were all hanged that morning in Mountjoy.
And a lot of people were waiting for news of the hanging. Literally thousands of people, apparently.
Yeah, so certainly after the news of the hanging came out, and possibly before, because people hoped for a reprieve, I think up to 40,000 people gathered outside Mountjoy. There was very striking scenes of particularly women kneeling and saying the rosary. There was a very large military cordon, you know, with troops in combat gear with steel helmets and fixed bayonets. The RAF were ordered to buzz the crowd, not to bomb the crowd now, but to fly low over the crowd to intimidate them. So, yeah, it was a very public, very, very tense scene. Also, the Labour movement later that day called a one-day general strike in protest, and the IRA went around the city encouraging businesses to close. I mean, what the IRA accounts say is that many of them went along with it anyway, you know, out of loyalty to the Republic, but the IRA made sure that they did as well. But it does go against the perception of the War of Independence, especially in Dublin, as being a small-scale clandestine thing by a few men, particularly with guns. It's really much broader than that. You know, it's a big kind of public engagement with these events.
Now, there was a British-imposed curfew in place at the time, which came into effect at 9 p.m. each night. But at 144 Pierce Street, at the time known as Great Brunswick Street, not that far away from the headquarters of G Division of the Dublin Metropolitan Police, the IRA were planning retaliation, or at least a unit of the IRA was planning retaliation. Tell me about this unit.
Well, the unit was a company of 3rd Battalion of the Dublin Brigade, and the Dublin Brigade had, well, it had 6 battalions in total, but in the city it had 4 battalions, 2 north of the river and 2 south of the river. In the opposite way to the postcodes, which we might associate now, so it sometimes gets confusing in that way, but like 2 battalion is north of the River Liffey and 3 battalion is south of the River Liffey, so the opposite of the postcode. But the orders given to IRA units, IRA companies, so the rank and file of the Dublin IRA, the part-time volunteers, if you like, was that they were to go out and retaliate, to go out and carry out some sort of attack on Crown forces. So this particular company of 3rd Battalion met there in 145 Great Brunswick Street, which was at the time a Catholic hall. This was where they would have paraded. Now, an IRA parade by this date, 1921, doesn't mean marching up and down. What it means is a secret meeting, you know, in a safe house where you go and you get the weapons out of the dumps and you try to go out and carry out some sort of shooting or bombing. Usually they'd homemade hand grenades. And that's what they did. They went out, they got their revolvers and their hand grenades. There was an attack on a police station on Marion Square, but the bomb seems to have bounced off the police station and it badly injured, blew off the leg of one volunteer, Sean Dowling. Now, the company was like regrouping, perhaps like debriefing, saying what went wrong in 144 Great Brunswick Street. When word appears to have reached the auxiliary police, so the famous auxiliaries, that they were there and that their weapons were there.
And this was the famous, or the infamous F Company, which was based in Dublin Castle, of the auxiliaries, a greatly feared unit.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the War of Independence is colloquially known as the Black and Tan War and so on, but the Black and Tan, strictly so-called, were recruits into the RIC, and they have a very mixed record. Like, some of them didn't do very much. Some of them were quite brutal. But the real, you know, feared auxiliary police were the auxiliary division of the RIC. Better equipped, better armed, not just drafted into the RIC like the Black and Tans, but their own units. F Company in particular were responsible, for example, for the summary execution of Dick McKee and Patrick Clancy and Conor Clun on the night of Bloody Sunday. So, you know, just torturing them, it appears, because they had bayonet wounds and beating them and then shooting them out of hand. You know, they were quite a feared unit.
So presumably they were tipped off that there was a company of IRA in 144 Pierce Street, or South Great Brunswick Street as it was then.
Yeah, it looks that way, Miles. What the IRA report said, IRA report was actually later captured by the British, said was that an ex-soldier by the name of Stephen Clark was acting as a spy, and the IRA knew about this. They were already tracking him. And what the IRA certainly thought was that Stephen Clark led the auxiliaries to the company meeting place on the day of the ambush. Now, as we'll probably get on to discussing, Stephen Clark was actually killed when fire broke out. But, you know, he might have been targeted anyway, because the IRA certainly suspected that he was behind the auxiliaries finding the company headquarters.
So the F Company of the Auxies, or at least part of F Company of the Auxies, arrive in force on Pierce Street with a Rolls-Royce armoured car and two tenders. What happens then?
So the auxiliaries arrived to raid the place. Now, you know, it appears, as we said, that they were acting on intelligence, but it wasn't like, say, a SWAT raid, for example, we might envisage today, you know. They were investigating it. So they arrived on the scene. When they did, the IRA company inside opened fire. So it was the IRA that initiated contact, to use military terms. So initially, like, there was eight auxiliaries in the first lorry. This is the unarmoured Crossley tender, as opposed to the Rolls-Royce armoured car. But five of them out of eight were hit, you know, by the small arms fire from the house. But the auxiliaries, you know, they had a heavy machine gun mounted in the Rolls-Royce armoured car. They had rifles. They had probably Lewis machine guns themselves. And so they greatly outgunned the IRA. Now, there was a pretty brief gun battle. It was a gun battle of about 5 minutes, which actually is very long by Dublin standards in the War of Independence, but, you know, very short in the scheme of things. And by the end of it, eight people, and we now know, were killed or mortally wounded.
Now, apportion the casualties or the fatalities, if you would. Some were civilians, some were auxiliaries, some were IRA.
Yeah, so two IRA men or volunteers were killed. One of them was an 18-year-old from Dundalk by the name of Bernard O'Hanlon, and he was shot outside 145, so he may have been outside the building when the firing broke out. He had fired two rounds from a revolver, and he was hit multiple times. Another one was Leo Fitzgerald. Leo Fitzgerald came from a distinguished kind of Republican rank-and-file family. Like, his brother was senior in the Fianna. His first name was Theobald Wolfe Tone Fitzgerald, Miles. That'll give you an idea, I would say, of the family's sympathies. They were killed instantaneously. Another three, I think, IRA men were wounded. And them, along with Sean Dowling, who was injured in the earlier incident, the grenade incident, were spirited away by Cumnagh Man women, who also took the weapons and the papers from the house to Mercer Street Hospital, where they were, you know, treated in secret by sympathetic medical people. The rest of the IRA company made their escape around the houses. There wasn't any arrests made, apart from one, who we'll get on to. But there was, we now know, three civilians killed or fatally wounded. One of them was actually the brother of a Sinn Féin MP, Thomas Kelly. There was a caretaker of one of the buildings was killed. Stephen Clark, who was the ex-soldier, 22 years old, who we now think may have been the informer who was working with the auxiliaries, he was killed when fire was opened. I just read this morning, actually, there was an elderly woman by the name of Mary Hogan who was killed, and she died of her wounds 1 month later in April 1921.
And two members of F Company lost their lives as well?
Right, two members of F Company, one of whom was the driver, Farrell, who was an Irishman. So, you know, not all the auxiliaries in Black and Tans were from Britain. Some of them were Irish. And another auxiliary, a war veteran by the name of Beard, were killed. And I think five more wounded, of whom three were sent to hospital.
And apparently the command of the company, the IRA company involved, was not pleased that this action had taken place.
Well, not the company, Miles, the battalion, so a bit higher up the scale. So Joe O'Connor, who was the commandant of 3rd Battalion, which, as I said, was the south inner city area, and along with 2 Battalion on the north side were the two most active battalions, he wrote later on that, you know, this was an example of what not to do as an urban guerrilla. So, you know, we were very poorly armed. I mean, according to British figures, for example, only 1 in 4 of the brigade had access to any kind of weapon. And the weapons they did have were usually handguns and improvised grenades. And what not to do was to get involved in the stand-up fight. So John O'Connor, for example, was of the opinion that, you know, if the safe house was being raided, the prudent thing was to get away, take away the arms and the papers, and just melt away. The prudent thing was not to get involved in a stand-up fight with forces who were much better armed and who could call reinforcements very, very quickly in the city centre. So, you know, Collins, also at the very top of the IRA, was very insistent on this point, especially in Dublin, there was to be no stand-up fights. And it was the same thing that went wrong in the Customs House raid a little bit later, but, you know, on a smaller scale, perhaps.
Attacks, though, continued in Dublin in the week following the 14th of March. So it would appear that the IRA was keen to exact some revenge for the executions in Mountjoy early on the morning of the 14th of March.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not just a question of revenge for the executions. I mean, by this point, the IRA campaign in Dublin is, you know, it's set. They set up the ASU in late 1920. The idea is to, you know, carry out the maximum amount of small attacks in the city. And it's tied in with the political struggle, really. It's to demonstrate that the, you know, British control of the capital is being disputed. Even if you can't do much from, you know, a strictly military nature, you can, if you like, give the appearance of a war zone, you know, which is important from a political point of view. But to answer your question, Miles, about the attacks, yeah, so for the following day, for example, a British soldier was shot and killed at Rialto Bridge, which in those days is just outside the city centre. 3 days later, there's an attack on a troop convoy on Dorset Street on the north side. The day after that, in one of the largest single attacks in terms of fatalities, there's 3 soldiers, British soldiers, killed and 5 wounded in a grenade attack on Wexford Street. So, yeah, certainly the attacks went on.
Now, to get back to the Pierce Street attack, there were 2 IRA men captured as they fled the scene of the battle. They didn't all manage to get away. Tell me about those 2 men, one of whom was extremely young, and what happened to them?
Well, one of them, as you say, Joseph Donnelly, was 17 years old, and he survived the period. I mean, he only had to survive a few more months because the truce came in July 11th, 1921. The other one, though, was Thomas Traynor, who was a 40-year-old married man. He was the father of 10 children, originally from Tullow, County Carlow. He had been involved in the Rising of 1916, and he was found that day with an automatic pistol. The pistol had fired no shots, you know, for the record. And what Thomas Traynor said was he had been involved in the Volunteers, yes. I think he'd been interned after 1916, but he was no longer involved, and he was bringing the weapon back to the dump for the Volunteers, but he hadn't been involved in the ambush. There was a quite protracted trial. He was defended by Michael Noick, who was a lawyer who was in the service of the Republican movement. And to no avail, Thomas Traynor was hanged later that month. He was convicted, I think, of levying war against the Crown forces, and he was hanged in Mountjoy Jail on April the 25th. Now, Joseph Donnelly was spared either because he was too young or possibly just he got lucky and the truce intervened.
But there was another death consequent on all of this because of the execution of Traynor, wasn't there?
Yeah, and it kind of shows the cycle of violence, Miles, that the War of Independence kind of embodied. So yeah, I mean, by this point, the British were executing IRA volunteers with reasonable regularity. I mean, not as many as the following year, actually, in the Civil War, the following 2 years. But the IRA reacted to British formal executions by saying, well, some of your personnel fall into our hands and we will kill them. We will execute them in retaliation. So that's what happened. There was an RIC district inspector by the name of Gilbert Potter who was being held at the time by the IRA, and he was shot or he was executed in retaliation for the execution of Thomas Traynor.
Now, there was a sequel to all of this in 2001. I remember it quite well. And it involved the exhumation of remains of IRA men in Mountjoy who had been hanged and their transfer to Glasnevin Cemetery. And I think a number of the people who died on that day were included in that group.
Yeah, so we started speaking, Miles, at the start of the interview about the six men who were hanged in Mountjoy on the morning of March 14th, 1921. And they were among the what's now known as the Forgotten Ten, who were reinterred and they were reburied in Glasnevin in the year 2001. And so was Thomas Traynor, for that matter, who was executed as a consequence of the ambush.
There was a certain amount of scepticism, I recall, at the time surrounding the transfer of these 10 bodies.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, one reading of it that was it's been expressed to me is that, you know, it was a long-running campaign. There was, had been an 80-year campaign, first of all, to identify the graves because they were buried in unmarked graves inside the prison walls. And then later on, you know, to exhume them and to reinter them in the Republican plot in Glasnevin. So that's one reading. Another reading at the time was that then Taoiseach Bertie Ahern had a general election coming up and he had a Fianna Fáil Ardéis around the same time. And that this was an attempt to kind of reassert Fianna Fáil's kind of Republican credentials. I mean, another thing Bertie Ahern did, this is kind of post-peace process era, of course, is that he reinstated for a time the Easter parade in commemoration of the Easter Rising, which had been stopped during the Northern Troubles. So a somewhat cynical interpretation of the reinterment of the Forgotten Ten would be that it was, you know, an attempt to recapture the Republican history of Fianna Fáil by Bertie Ahern. But the other interpretation being, of course, that it was the culmination of a long-standing campaign.
Yeah, well, we don't tolerate cynicism on the History Show, John. So,
I should hope not.
But thank you. Thank you for pointing out the cynicism of others on that particular occasion. John Doherty, thank you very much indeed. The 14th of March, 100 years ago today, an eventful day. A fateful day indeed in the War of Independence. And my guest, John Dorney, is the author of two books, The Civil War in Dublin and Peace After the Final Battle, The Story of the Irish Revolution 1912 to 1924, which has just been re-released, as it happens, in paperback. John, many thanks again for joining us on The History Show this evening.
Thank you very much.
That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. Our researcher is Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer, Logan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.